far reaches of the universe is the star planet Symbion, a perfect world until their biological experiments exploded, creating an exotic realm beyond all belief. As mutant life forms ravaged their global paradise, a new and incredible species emerged, the Sectars. With Prince Dargon leading his warriors of the Shining Realm against the evil General Spydrax, he would destroy all to rule all. His terror troops of the Dark Domain know no mercy. The brave, the bold, and the fearless stand with Dargon. The brutal and cruel attack with Spydrax. These are the Sectars, the warriors of Symbion.
Searching my past for the things that I've seen. Is it my life or just something I dream?
Resume. Noun. 1. A summing up. Summary. 2. A brief written account of personal, educational, and professional qualifications and experience.
January of 1985 appears to have been a great month for books I barely remember having read well after the point of initial publication. Some, like Sisterhood of Steel number 2, I know for a fact that I read, owned, may still have in a box somewhere, and yet continues to mean absolutely nothing to me. Others, like Amazing Spider-Man number 264, were borrowed from a friend, read once, sucked, and yet still linger on in the fringes of my mind. Football player, given powers by suit, sweats a lot, and meets an unfortunate fate. Maybe it was down to the extra thought and care that went into an inventory story by a writer with 3 whole credits in his career working with Dave Cockrum's wife. I don't think I bought Marvel Comics' adaptation of 2010, one of their more inexplicable licenses, but I did randomly get a book and record set from a dollar store at some point. What possessed me, I cannot say, and I've never seen the movie proper. I believe that I did the same with Dune, and seriously, aren't we a little deep into the just say no era for whatever Marvel was smoking? I want to say I also had the record for Dune, but definitely one of the comic issues. I mean, sure, they apparently couldn't adapt the book into a single movie, but surely the single movie would fit into a 3-issue miniseries. This thing had Bill Sienkiewicz art at a time that I only liked his covers, so I guess I was just keeping an eye out for the next Star Wars. This oddity surely wasn't that, no matter how much the producers wished otherwise. Sienkiewicz clearly labored over extensive reference, but it still wasn't putting the property over with myself or the rest of Marvel's audience. I skipped G.I. Joe because it was way too Top Gun, an entire issue devoted to aerial combat. Doctor Strange number 70 doesn't look like something my brother would have bought, so I guess I thumbed through it out of the grocery sack of comics. Brett Blevins wasn't my bag back then, but today I have a presumably bootleg miniature silkscreen of the cover that Third Planet must have gotten a bulk rate on that year. I want to say I fished Micronauts number 8 out of a quarter bin in 89 for the obvious Aliens ripoff, but if I got into that, I'd have to reference all the back issues of Grimjack I was picking up that same year. Too much of a reach. I probably read my brother's copy of Web of Spider-Man number 1 in that same time frame. Marvel pushed that book hard in house ads, which I more readily recall than the book itself. From the beginning, Webb stank of lesser lights and brand extension. Who launches a Spider-Man title with Jim Mooney inks, especially over a journeyman like Greg LaRocque? The book had a nice, moody, painted Charles Vest cover, which despite being pretty, wasn't very effective as a debut issue cover, didn't reflect the tone of the book at all, and had Spider-Man in a black costume that he would lose before the end of this particular issue. Tales of the Teen Titans number 52 fared better, with the return of Cheshire from my beloved New Teen Titans annual number 2, nice art by Rich Buckler and Mike DiCarlo, and a pleasant enough thriller origin solo story for Jericho. I retained a soft spot for Joe Wilson despite his ugly costume, Aryan Jufro, and mutton chops. Shame that he only got more awful from there, the permullet, for example. I can't recall if I read a friend's or my half-brother's copy of Uncanny X-Men number 192. The premise of contracting the transmode virus was mildly terrifying, but not quite as much as Colossus and Rogue's new costumes. Ugh. I love the ending to Kitty Pryde Wolverine number 6 as a kid, with Logan forced to give in to a berserker rage to defeat Ogun, only to be personally defeated by that resort. Plus, Shadowcat was born, however meaningless that might be now. Poor girl struggles for years to work out a decent code name, and now nobody bothers to use it anymore. Apologies, the moonlighting lettering great Todd Klein, but Blue Devil number 11 was so bad I skipped the next two issues. And a reread in the past decade reminded me that it's still terrible by more nostalgic, forgiving standards. I think I gave Peter Porker the Spectacular Spider-Ham number 1 a chance, but I was older and less impressionable than I was when Marvel Tales came out. I got Captain America number 305 out of a grocery store 3-pack and was intrigued by the premise of a British captain. Ma Dread the Mystic had taken control of Brian Braddock to instigate a fight, so I was confused when my brother turned up with a copy of Marvel Chillers number 1 a few years later, where Modred was used as a protagonist. While I thought the costume was kind of nice, I was unimpressed with Captain Britain's fallibility and excessive powers, a bias that continues to this day. I was also underwhelmed by the Paul Neary art and fought off buying another issue until 1987. Finally, I picked up Ewoks number 1 at the 7-Eleven, despite it being 2 years distant from Return of the Jedi and following at least one of those cheesy ABC television movie events. My hope is that I owned several Ewok action figures because they were heavily discounted, and I'm confident that's at least partially true, but I also strongly suspect that I was just that enamored with the squat little murder bears. For some reason, I really dug the removable cowl covering the head of the chieftain. I think it was held in place with ears and little clefts. I had an odd fixation on sampling Star Comics, despite having outgrown their target demographic. Not that they ever hit the broad side of that demographic, hence the whole abject failure thing. I'd get suckered at least one more time by Lucas Properties, but I never bought this series again. I kind of went nuts buying comics at the first of the year, so maybe I had gotten some money over the holidays. That must have been spent by February of 1985. The painted Monica Rambeau Captain Marvel cover to the Mighty Avengers number 255 was memorable. Maybe not so much for the story, but I still have a bootleg silkscreen of this one too. DC Comics Presents number 81 came out of the quarter bin at Marauder Books in 1989 as part of my slowly growing ambush bug collection. But let's get back to the contemporaneous February 1985 items. I remember nothing about G.I. Joe, Real American Hero number 36, besides the John Byrne cover, and the Dreadnoks taking a chainsaw to the wing of a plane, but I'm still confident I bought the thing. Before Uncanny X-Men number 193, I'd never even heard of Thunderbird, but it was easy enough to follow the story of his younger brother assuming the identity of a deceased loved one to take over NORAD and attempt to avenge the death. Picking up from Kitty Pryde and Wolverine, Shadowcat was in effect, and Logan was his established badass self. The Hellions weren't that impressive, but this was a great-looking, extra-length anniversary issue with pathos and scheming enough to impress. I still wasn't a monthly follower, but I sure enjoyed the book each time I took the plunge. Rocket Raccoon number 1 was a pretty random book to chase with. I think I was taken by the Starlin-esque cosmic weirdness of it all, and the juxtaposition of funny animals with the grimly violent mayhem in Mike Mignola's art. This was before his work was 70% solid blacks, and in fact the main appeal was the hyper-detailing that recalled Michael Golden, godfather of the Image style. Maybe a little too indebted, as Golden Bucky O'Hare had debuted in Echo of Future Past about a year earlier. It's also worth noting that scripter Bill Mantlo had co-created the Micronauts comic with Golden, and has a bit of a reputation for pilfering other creators' ideas. I generally liked his writing, but I think this was still a shade too whimsical for my taste. I'm also relieved to find this book can be found south of $50, so I don't have to feel too much remorse over having brutalized and discarded my copy. Sectors was a swell toy line, but it presented the same problem for me as the soon-to-come Thundercats. I couldn't afford it on my end of the poverty line. My recollection is that Sectors was priced at roughly one G.I. Joe over the cost of a He-Man, which Vice President Bush referred to as voodoo economics. Master of the Universe kept costs down through constant recycling of molds and limited, inexpensive articulation. The Sectors were superior in sculpt, construction, and play value, but I only ever got Prince Dagon, or maybe Commander Waspex too. Besides the excellent posability, the other thing I remember about Prince Dargon was that he had an extra squishy hollow head, with more give than a He-Man. And I do mean that's all I remember, because I forgot Dargon's name before looking it up, and I will surely forget it again as soon as I'm done with this recording. Fact is, I had to edit out screwing up the name while recording. As much as I liked moving his limbs and putting weapons in his sturdy hands, I never got a sense of the toy's personality, so he never got a lot of playtime. None of the other Sectors really did much for me, and everyone had similar looking armor with mild color variations. It felt to me like you only needed one, really, and I already had the best of them, so why buy more? Another issue was that Sectors emphasized the little bug companions with low novelty gimmicks like squirting water. To get a broader range of characters, you had to spring for vehicles, or rather giant bugs that often doubled as hand puppets and cost a bloody fortune. There was apparently a 5-episode cartoon miniseries, but I never saw it, and only one series of figures was ultimately produced. On the surface, the comics seemed above average for licensed fare, as Marvel saw Mark Texiera's potential from the failed DC Power Lords adaptation, and one-upped them with writer Bill Mantlow, yes, him again, in hopes of producing the next G.I. Joe, or at least another ROM. Didn't happen. But I bought more than the first issue, so I must have liked some of what I got. It was basically the same knights versus monsters stuff that was everywhere at the time. Looking through the first issue, I find it all a bit too dense, like the Dune of toy lines, literally similar to the look of the David Lynch movie. All the pages have too many panels, and the art lacks Texiera's familiar flourishes and dynamism. The characters seem interchangeable and drab. With the Star line having launched, this would have been the natural place for Sectors, but there was this ill-considered hierarchy where Star only targeted the littlest of kids. Sektor is one of the older G.I. Joe and Transformers kids, but I suspect that the material was too heavy for the right audience and too nakedly toyetic for the preteens and up. It seemed like maybe Coleco had done up a Bible of lore in-house, suffocating any potential contributions from Marvel, who were frankly better at telling stories than toy companies. Like Power Lords, I think it was too dark and funky looking, and like Black Star, it was swords and sorcery in an oversaturated market already dominated by stronger entries. I confess I had more Power Lords and Black Star toys than Sectors, even though Adam Power looked like a Fran Tarkenton action figure. I also have to point out that the Sectors comic book was released bi-monthly, a death kiss in those days, and I'm pretty sure that it launched well before the toys or cartoon miniseries were available. Less a forerunner than a canary in the collectibles coal mine. I only picked up a few comic books from March of 1985. I recall seeing Amazing Spider-Man number 265 in a 3-pack and not being impressed. While I've never to this day continued the Captain Britain Modred story into Captain America number 306 because of that lousy cover, not that Paul Neary's interiors were any more scintillating. Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man number 103, had a compelling cover, but I think Spidey just fought normal people inside, so I didn't follow up on it. I pulled a surprisingly solid Tales of the Teen Titans number 54 out of a quarter bin, but that was so many years later, anytime from 1989 to the early 90s, that it doesn't really count here. I definitely flipped through Moon Knight, Fist of Khonshu number 1, which looked like a classic illustrated on literal steroids and about as exciting. I'm not confident that I bought it new. Ambush Black number 1 would have to wait until 1987 as one of the few back issues bought at my first neighborhood comic shop. Having noted those I passed on or otherwise deferred, the books I did buy this month stuck with me long after the fact. Dreadstar and Company number 1 was one of the most important comics I've ever purchased. I still had beat-up copies of my uncle's abandoned Captain Marvel and Warlock comics, which had made me a fan of Jim Starlin for as long as I could remember. However, this was easily the most influential and my favorite of the three. Dreadstar was Starlin purging himself of all his rage against organized religion, Catholicism specifically, and the military-industrial complex with a clarity inaccessible during the acid trips of his earlier work. Here, Starlin moved away from his strong Silver Age influences and looked to older masters like Hal Foster and Alex Raymond, a stylistic renaissance that marked the pinnacle of his abilities. The actual story in this one comic is no great shakes. A lengthy recap of the Metamorphosis Odyssey from Epic Illustrated, the 1981 Eclipse original painted volume The Price, and Marvel graphic novel number 3, followed by a cute high story that demonstrated the book as a whole being a well above average Star Wars pastiche. Not unlike Firefly, come to think of it. However, the ground covered here got a young reader up to speed on a rich cosmos of continuity, and I was ravenous for successive issues. Daredevil number 220 sported a striking cover cover, which complemented a story that haunted my memory forevermore. Matt Murdock's ex-girlfriend, Heather Glenn, wouldn't leave him alone until something happened to her that he couldn't ignore. Driven by guilt, Daredevil investigated the circumstances of a tragedy and was not at all consoled by the answers he found. Where Dreadstar had epic scope that confronted me with big issues, this story was one of the first mature works I read, in that it made me keenly aware of the choices made in life that are irrevocable and often damning. The sick feeling of responsibility for the damage suffered by others is a weight we all carry, and Denny O'Neil warned me in a tale far more sophisticated than the preachy 70s garbage he built his legacy upon. David Mazzucchelli was a perfect complement, defining grim and gritty with a moody noir that illustrated true human frailty. This was more than an entertaining periodical. This meant something. And I got it out of a three-pack from Kmart. Finally, there was New Mutants number 29, initially the dog of a three-pack, possibly the same one I got the Daredevil out of. Bill Sienkiewicz was the poster boy for bad art in my eyes, and a critic in training boasted that even I could draw better, which is a bold-faced lie at the most basic level before considering Sienkiewicz's challenging the boundaries between funny books and fine art. Chris Claremont's scripts were ever a poor conduit for Sienkiewicz's pretensions, offering mutant punks and gladiatorial combat and purple prose. I singled the book out in an attempt to get rid of it at a garage sale, but nobody was buying. It stayed in my collection, and as my sensibilities matured, I began to realize my initial evaluation was clearly that of a child. I never truly developed an affection for Sienkiewicz, but more proper respect did come.
Now being without you takes a lot of getting used to. Should learn to live with it, but I don't want to. Being without you is out of the mistake. Instead of getting easier, it's the hardest thing to take. I'm addicted to your faith. You're a hard habit to break.
My best guess is that in the spring of 1985, my stepsisters were living with us in a two-story apartment with cable television, by which I mean that we weren't paying for five people to go out to the movies. The original Angel, honor student by day, hooker by night, was possibly an early video store rental, and perhaps even seen edited for television on UHF. Either way, we weren't up for the wholly unnecessary and clearly inferior sequel, Avenging Angel. Ditto Tough Turf, an early James Spader teeny bopper vehicle with Robert Downey Jr. as his sidekick. Spader is miscast as the cool new kid in school, relying on a bicycle, while trying to steal the big bully's girl. I don't think I ever finished it, and my only takeaway was that a car antenna could be used as a whip in a fight. I saw and adored The Breakfast Club during a UHF broadcast in 1987 while living in Nevada. Into the Night was another rental, a neo-noir pairing Jeff Goldblum and Michelle Pfeiffer, dodging a homicidal David Bowie. The cast was reason enough to watch, but also more or less the only strong motivation to do so. Lust in the Dust was definitely oddball early cable fare, in which aging former heartthrob Tab Hunter stars in a parody of a spaghetti western, against the dueling love interests of an already middle-aged Zoftig Lainey Kazan and the infamous drag queen Divine. My long-term John Cusack fandom extended to a single television viewing of The Sure Thing late in the decade. Things theatrical seemed to pick up, sort of, heading into March. Of all the things to go out for, I think we caught Turk 182 at the Dollar Show, in which Timothy Hutton uses graffiti protests to seek justice for his paralyzed firefighter brother, played by Robert Urich. It was chronologically correct that I should start the Missing in Action series with part 2, the beginning. This was clearly one of my stepfather's picks, and it developed a very mild, very limited secondhand appreciation of Chuck Norris, the poor man standing in for every other action star. Aside from martial arts skills, Norris had very little offer the silver screen, but he gave it in abundance. Here he does his best Rambo impersonation as Braddock, a POW in Vietnam who has to break himself out of a Kong camp. I certainly can't forget Mask, about a sweet kid with a deformed face struggling with family, relationship, and medical issues. Eric Stoltz was unrecognizable in perhaps his warmest and most human role, buried under a ton of makeup. This would be one of my earliest exposures to the legendary mustache of Sam Elliott, and also the glory of Cher, the biggest celebrity to ever respond to me on Twitter. If you're wondering, it was because she had expressed a favorable response to John Kasich during his presidential bid, and I pointed out his having hidden his past anti-choice legislation from national voters. Anyway, how's this for a segue? Way. Porky's Revenge. We had seen Porky's 2 the next day at the Dollar Show a couple of years earlier, and it had made quite an impression on me. Yes, my parents were in fact deeply irresponsible people, and we all watched the original Porky's on cable soon after. I'm not certain of the time frame for seeing the finale, easily the worst of the lot, but I vividly recall the black and white newspaper ad for this one. Finally, I'm not proud to acknowledge having seen the first three or four Police Academy movies theatrically, of which 1985 offered the second, subtitled Their First Assignment. It was definitely the best of the sequels, and may even rival the original, for whatever that's worth. Besides the affable smugness of Steve Guttenberg and the pleasant presence of Howard Hessman, we were introduced to the early comedy stylings of one Bobcat Goldthwait, former poster child for one-trick hacks, with his screaming followed by his whiny mumbling in a seemingly endless loop. I was still at a Police Academy level of humor appreciation, so Bobcat fit right in with Tiny Black Lady with a squeaky voice who screams occasionally, Dude imitates sound effects with his mouth, Aggressive Woman who invites sexual harassment because large breasts, Ex-football player who demonstrates feats of strength, Asian who speaks in broken pigeon English, Accidental fellatio, Nerd abuse, Gay panic, and the hilariously clumsy excessive force guy. That said, Bobcat eventually became a surprisingly effective and sensitive writer-director of pitch black comedies, and also enjoyed his occasional turns as a guest VJ on Friday Night Videos with future SpongeBob Tom Kenny. Not much new on television in springtime, but Robotech apparently ran in syndication early in 1985. It came on in the early afternoon, so I recall trying to get home after school in time to catch maybe the last 15 minutes of each episode. I was drawn more to the soap opera than the numbing mech battles, particularly that time Rick Hunter got caught in a bomb shelter with Lisa Hayes, and the romantic tension overshadowed his relationship with the pop idol Minmay. Do you think I should dye my hair blue again? I vaguely recollect CBS Story Break on Saturday mornings, which did animated adaptations of kids' books and offered read more about it segments. Way on the other end of the spectrum was the TV movie A Bunny's Tale, a fictionalized account of Gloria Steinem's time as an investigative journalist at a Playboy Club starring Kirstie Alley. There are several reasons that would give you a nauseated shiver, and it's the correct response to all of them. The last is far from the least, since I've occasionally considered podcasting on it as a subject all its own. There's nothing at 8 to hold my attention, but my mom and I were down for mood lighting from the pilot episode. Like Remington Steele, it was about a private investigation agency with a lady boss having sexual tension with an insubordinate male partner. That's about where the similarities ended, though, as Sybil Shepherd's Maddie Hayes was much icier and more dependent, while the Blue Moon Detective Agency was just an asset the former model was able to hold on to after going bankrupt or think she got ripped off by her agent or something. Meanwhile, David Addison was the exact opposite of James Bond type, which would serve the young Bruce Willis well in his future star turn in Die Hard. That's not to say he wasn't already made a star by moonlighting, much to the chagrin of Shepard, but only a TV star. TV did not get anywhere near the respect back then as it does today. Moonlighting was one of the first so-called dramedies, able to mix screwball comedy with relationship drama, and maybe helped give me a taste for genre blending. It was also an early adopter of meta-commentary, as the characters would sometimes break the fourth wall to talk to the audience about the show. They'd also get really nuts on occasion, and say, do a tongue-in-cheek adaptation of The Taming of the Shrew for no apparent reason. Yeah, Joss Whedon definitely owed a debt to Glenn Gordon Carroll. I watched the show enough that I could probably still sing the Al Jarreau theme song from memory, despite not seeing an episode since the dawn of DVD. So who wanted to see our resume? How about 21st Century Boys, Dr. Ange, Between the Pages, Chris at Bad Books for Beginners, Chris Dunford, Doc Strange, Ed Moore, History of Comics on Film, I Was Joe Is, The Irredeemable Shag, Jeffrey Brown, They Them, Yoslin Yosin, Keith G. Baker, Marvel Universe Online Project, Mike at Zendavians to Me, Randy Caldwell, Siskoid, Slangward Scott, Spawner, Superbound, Tim Price, the Pod Crasher, who offered. I got four of these right off the stands. New Teen Titans was a year later in Tales of the Teen Titans, Tom Beach, Troy Wilson, 101 Warrior for Peace Podcast, and Xenozoic Xenophiles. Searching my mind for some truth to reveal. What thoughts are fantasies?